It is Monday, July the 16th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, Helsinki hosting another U.S.-Russia summit.
President Trump was very intent to hold a summit-style meeting with Vladimir Putin, and so that's exactly what's happening.
Also ahead, U.S.-North Korea relations and Israel concerned about neighboring Syria.
They're concerned specifically about the number of Iranian forces that are intermixed with that of the Assad regime.
Plus, a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has arrived in Helsinki, Finland, for his closely watched summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Finland has a long legacy of hosting U.S., Soviet, and U.S. Russian summits because of its geographic location and its perceived neutrality. The American ambassador to Moscow, John Huntsman, spoke with reporters about the significance of the summit.
This is really the first time for both presidents to actually sit across the table and have a conversation. And I hope it's a detailed conversation about where we might be able to find some overlapping and shared interests.
VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman is in Helsinki with the president. My colleague Lori London asked him what the expectations for the summit might be.
There are quite low expectations for this meeting from everybody, including President Trump, who said that nothing bad's going to come out of it and maybe some good will come out of it. But he said he's going in with low expectations, not high expectations. And I can't tell you what's going to happen. And that may have a lot of people questioning, well, why are they doing this meeting in the first place? But according to White House officials, President Trump was very intent to hold a summit-style meeting with Vladimir Putin, and so that's exactly what's happening. And we know that, first of all, in the early afternoon here in Helsinki, that there will be a one-on-one meeting between the two leaders. The only other people that are supposed to be in the room will be their interpreters, and that will be followed by a more extended meeting with cabinet secretaries, cabinet ministers, and other officials in the room. And then we're supposed to have what the White House is billing as a joint availability, what the Finnish president's office is calling a news conference. And if it's like anything that happened the other day with Theresa May in England, we'll probably have extensive comments from the president, and he may be answering more than two or three questions with Vladimir Putin by his side.
So the president really hasn't spoken much about what he hopes to achieve?
He has spoken about a number of topics that he wants to speak with Putin about, including nuclear disarmament, Syria, the wider issue of the Middle East. And he has also somewhat proactively answering reporters at a news conference the other day, saying that he will absolutely raise this issue of election meddling. But that was before this latest blockbuster indictment we had on Friday, in which 12 Russian military agents were charged with essentially meddling in the 2016 presidential election. It'll be very, very interesting, I think, to see how the president responds to questions at the news conference about how extensively he gets into it with Putin about this election interference, which, of course, is the subject that the special counsel in the United States is investigating.
A lot of people, though, are asking specifically, how will we know what they talked about if there's no one present in that one-on-one meeting?
Correct. Yes, you will have that one-on-one meeting, and then it's up to whatever the two presidents decide to tell us at the news conference about what they discussed. But there will then be that larger meeting that takes place where we know and we'll have a readout of the wider range of issues. But, of course, there is intense curiosity and intense speculation and intense concern, especially in Washington, about that one-on-one meeting. And a number of Democratic senators and even one Republican senator, John McCain, said that the president should not be meeting with Putin one-on-one.
What about the comments the president just made in Europe about the press being the enemy of the American people, given that we know Vladimir Putin is, how you say, not so friendly to to journalists. He oppresses journalists, and there have been murdered journalists.
How does he reconcile
that?
That may be something that he's asked about at the news conference, and also there will be reporters from both the United States and Russia putting questions to President Putin as well. And after what happened with the combative exchange that the president had with correspondents for NBC and CNN, I would expect that this issue will be raised when he's standing alongside Putin.
How are people there and in the surrounding countries looking at this, taking this? What are they thinking? Are they concerned?
Yes, I can give you a bit of a snapshot from the Baltic states, and people here are apprehensive. They're nervous. You have these two powerful leaders meeting. This is a region that is very sensitive. Finland itself was a Grand Duchy of Imperial Russia and has had sort of a neutral relationship, although they've drawn closer to the West in recent decades. I was over to Estonia, Tallinn, the capital there, speaking to people, and that's the tiniest of the Baltic states. That's a former Soviet Socialist Republic. They're members of NATO and the European Union, and they've been watching what's happening and the comments that President Trump has been making and the aggressiveness of Putin's Russia in recent years, both towards its neighbors, the situation in Ukraine with Crimea, of course, and meddling in elections not only in the United States but other countries as well. So they realize possibly their fates are in the hands of these two men who will be meeting in Helsinki today.
That is VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman speaking with my colleague Lori London. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. Syrian government forces unleashed hundreds of missiles on rebel-held areas near the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights on Sunday, the latest phase in an offensive to clear southern Syria of its insurgents. The government's push came after it had secured control of most of Daraa province in an offensive that began in June. On Sunday, the first batch of armed fighters and their families left the city of Daraa for the provincial capital it is in buses, and they would take on to the rebel-held Idlib province in the north. Similar deals in other parts of Syria resulted in the evacuation of thousands of opposition fighters and civilians, evacuations the UN and rights groups have decried as forced displacement. VOA's Victor Beatty asked the Washington Institute for Near East Policy senior fellow Andrew Tabler if the Syrian civil war is in a new phase.
We are entering a new phase of the conflict. It is unclear what these moves will mean ahead of the Putin-Trump summit, but it's hard to believe that any of this will be happening without the agreement of Israel.
Obviously, with Syrian forces approaching that close to the Israeli frontier, Israel must be very concerned.
Israel is concerned. They're concerned specifically about the number of Iranian forces that are intermixed with that of the Assad regime.
Daraa province now back and mostly in the hands of government forces. That's, of course, the cradle where the rebellion began 7 years ago. Now we have reports the Syrian government has restored control over 60% of previously held rebel territory.
The Assad regime forces have reestablished control, but not without a significant amount of Iranian and Russian support. It's not the Assad regime of old that won the civil war, but rather a new hybrid version that has neighboring countries, Israel and Turkey specifically, uncomfortable with the outcome of that war.
President Bashar Assad speaking during a meeting Sunday with visiting Iranian Foreign Ministry official Hossein Jabri Ansari. His office said the two agreed that, quote, the elimination of terrorism in most of the Syrian territory has laid the most appropriate ground to reach results at the political level. What do you think that might mean?
The meeting between Assad and his Iranian counterparts is designed to try and cement relations between the Assad regime and the Islamic Republic. Fighting terrorism for both of these countries is simply shooting the opposition to Assad into submission.
There's a late report from Reuters that, according to Syrian state media, Israeli rockets hit a Syrian military position near the city of Aleppo, near the Nayrab airport. How significant is that?
It's fairly significant that such strikes from Israel would be occurring, especially on the eve of the Trump-Putin summit.
Is the civil war over in Syria, effectively?
The civil war is drawing to a close. The problem is the way it's ending is unacceptable to neighboring countries, Israel in particular, and therefore the war threatens now to go sideways.
Andrew, what happens to the peace process, the nascent peace process now?
I think you're going to see efforts to try and get each side to the table, but with Assad riding high, with Iran winning, and Russia brokering various deals, it's going to be uncertain to see what kind of peace process could really deliver a peaceful Syria and one that's stable.
President Putin, of course, has been the center of a lot of diplomacy between Israel's leader, Iranian officials, and, of course, President Trump on Monday in Helsinki. What role will Mr. Putin play, and what do you think the two world leaders, Mr. Trump, Mr. Putin, will talk about?
I think they will talk about trying to get U.S. troops out of Syria. It's a long-term goal of Russia to do that. The question is what in return, and if it's related to Russian activities and that of the United States and around Ukraine and Crimea.
What will Israel want, and what will Iran want?
Israel wants Iranian forces out of Syria. Iran wants to maintain its presence in Syria for the foreseeable future.
Obviously, these goals can't be met.
They cannot.
Andrew Tabler is a senior fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's also the author of many books, including In the Lion's Den, an eyewitness account of Washington's battle with Syria. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. With prayers and other events, Turkey has commemorated the second anniversary of thwarting a coup against Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his government. Erdogan spoke to the crowds.
Bugün hem derin bir kederi hem de büyük bir gururu.
He said, "Today we feel in our hearts a huge sadness and huge pride at the same time. On the one hand, we feel the sadness of having lost 250 or more of our citizens in one night, and on the other hand, the pride of having undertaken a resistance that is so rarely seen in the world." Erdogan also referred to Fethullah Gulen, the U.S.-based cleric Turkey blames for the coup, and said the government has brought down Gulen's network within the public and private sectors. VOA asked former U.S. ambassador to Turkey, James Jeffrey, now a distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, where Turkey stands 2 years after the coup attempt.
First of all, it has had a huge change with the 2017 presidential referendum and then the election of current president, and he was the president since 2014, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and a new parliament where, interestingly, his party no longer has a majority. So that's an interesting situation. But in terms of the coup, several things. First of all, there was a lot of skepticism initially. We have Kerry's statement, with statements by some American military personnel, but it turns out that there has been no other explanation of this coup other than it was the Gulenist movement that launched it. And people need to think a little bit about that, because there was a lot of feeling of, well, maybe if, you know, whatever Erdogan says has to be wrong. If he says the sun rises in the east, take a look at the west. And we said a lot of this, and it really hurt the relationship with the United States. Now, fortunately, the Trump administration has issued a very nice statement out of the State Department commending the Turkish people for putting down, which was a coup against a democratically elected government and a very violent one, 250 people killed. And so slowly but surely, we're trying to recover from what I think was a really big mistake.
James Jeffrey, Distinguished Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and former U.S. Ambassador to Turkey. U.S. and North Korean officials held talks on Sunday. They discussed the return of U.S. service members, their remains missing from the Korean War. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who was not part of the talk, said in a statement that working-level meetings between the U.S. and North Korean officials would begin today. That's Monday. We asked Joshua Pollack, Senior Research Associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, how important was the Sunday meeting.
I think it's important to show that there is forward movement on the commitments made in Singapore. This was one of the four major points in that agreement. It was the last one, number four. By pursuing it, it makes good on a North Korean commitment, and it also demonstrates, perhaps more subtly, that the two sides have an understanding that the four points are not to be addressed in that order only, but can be addressed simultaneously. This is important because the first point is the improvement of relations. The second point is a peace regime, and the third point is denuclearization.
The four points for mutual effort did come out of that June meeting in Singapore between President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Nancy Sinatra, the first wife of entertainer Frank Sinatra, has died. She was 101 years old. AP's Julie Walker reports.
I got a woman crazy for me.
The Sinatra family website chose the Frank Sinatra song She's Funny That Way as a dedication to Nancy Sinatra with the words, "Godspeed, Mama, and thank you for everything you did for us and for the world." Nancy and Frank were teenage sweethearts who married in 1939. She worked as a secretary to help support them before he became famous. They divorced after he left her for actress Ava Gardner, but remained close until his death two decades ago. Nancy and Frank had three children, Frank Jr., Tina, and the singer Nancy Jr. I'm Julie Walker.
Still ahead on International Edition, the sounds of Beyoncé. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Despite an outcry from animal rights activists, a number of consumer product manufacturers still rely on animal testing to determine if their goods are safe for people to use. Scientists at Johns Hopkins University say, in a new study, new and advanced algorithms that draw on information from large chemical databases can more accurately predict chemical toxicity than animal tests. Thomas Hartung, the study's principal investigator and director of the Center for Alternatives to Animal Testing at Johns Hopkins, calls his team's research findings a real eye-opener. He says the results suggest that this computer and database system could not only replace animal testing, but would also provide more reliable results. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition, so good to have you with us today. It is time now for a little something from the world of music. Beyoncé Giselle Knowles-Carter is an American singer, songwriter, dancer, actress, and businesswoman. She rose to fame in the late 1990s as the lead singer of the R&B girl group Destiny's Child. On a break from the group to make a movie, Beyoncé also released her debut album, Dangerously in Love, in 2003. The album established her as a solo artist worldwide, earning 5 Grammy Awards and featuring the song we're listening to now, which became a Billboard Hot 100 number one single, Crazy in Love. Following the breakup of Destiny's Child in 2006, Beyoncé released her second solo album, B-Day. And her marriage to rapper Jay-Z and portrayal of Etta James in the film Cadillac Records in 2008 influenced her third album, I Am Sasha Fierce. Beyoncé earned a record-setting 6 Grammy Awards for the album in 2010, including Song of the Year for Single Ladies. Throughout her solo career, Beyoncé has sold more than 100 million records worldwide, making her one of the world's best-selling music artists. She has won 22 Grammy Awards and is the most nominated woman in awards history. A fan favorite, the song Halo received critical acclaim and lots of awards and nominations. The ballad was placed at number 7 on Wrap-Up's list of the 25 best songs of 2009. Beyoncé and her husband Jay-Z have 3 children. Daughter Blue Ivy was born in 2012, and twins Rumi and Sir were born in 2017. And in the New Yorker magazine, music critic Jody Rosen described Beyoncé as the most important and compelling popular musician of the 21st century.
Burning.
one amazing song. You should check out the video for this song. Absolutely spectacular. Beyonce out on tour right now, too. She's going all kinds of places. A former First Lady, Michelle Obama, I understand, was at a recent concert. How about that? Listen, many thanks, everyone, for joining us for International Edition here on The Voice of America. It's always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman. We're all in Washington hoping you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from Beyonce.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Ebola survivors in Sierra Leone will have some much-needed help in recovering from the deadly disease through the assistance of the United States. On July 28th, U.S. Ambassador to Sierra Leone, Maria Brewer, gave opening remarks during a handover ceremony of 19 categories of specialized medicines worth $215,000 to support emerging needs and medical care for Ebola survivors. These medicines are a donation from the United States government through the United States Agency for International Development, or USAID. The ceremony took place at the University of Sierra Leone Teaching Hospital Complex, Connaught Hospital, and underscored the United States government's support for the Ministry of Health and Sanitation health system strengthening efforts during the post-Ebola recovery period. The United States government donation of medicines to the Ministry of Health and Sanitation is a symbol of our greater commitment to promoting and supporting the Global Health Security Agenda, or GHSA. GHSA provides an innovative, proactive approach to prevent, detect, and respond to future disease outbreaks. The medicines will be available in 20 hospitals nationwide to populations covered under the Sierra Leone Government Free Healthcare Initiative. These medicines will help treat a number of medical conditions experienced by Ebola virus disease survivors, which are also common among the general Sierra Leone population, such as eye care, mental health and neurology, ear, nose, and throat conditions, and joint pain. Overall, U.S. government investments in the health sector contribute directly to the new government of Sierra Leone's priorities as outlined in the new direction, One Country, One People, with a focus on strengthening service delivery and expanding and improving free health care to vulnerable populations. More specifically, by making these specialty medicines available, the Ministry of Health and Sanitation can improve access to specialized care at the national and district levels, which is expected in the long term to strengthen the referral system between primary health care and hospitals. The United States is proud to work with its partner Sierra Leone to improve health care and disease prevention for the wonderful people of Sierra Leone.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.